Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town.
Welcome, everybody, to the Weekend Interview Show on Radio. I am your host, Phil Drew, Administrator. Our guest today is Stephen Yates, who is a fellow, or pardon me, an adjunct scholar at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. And actually, before I introduce Mr. Yates fully and bring him on, I want to play a clip for you from the former President of the United States, Bill Clinton, accepting the nomination for President in 1992.
As a teenager, I heard John Kennedy's summons to citizenship. And then, as a student at Georgetown, I heard that call clarified by a professor named Carol Quigley.
Okay. Bill Clinton's call to citizenship was clarified by his professor, Carol Quigley. Carol Quigley was one of the most important nonfiction authors of the 20th century for a great many reasons. And here to talk about Carol Quigley and other things related to that is Stephen Yates. He has a PhD in philosophy, is an adjunct scholar at the Ludwig von Mises Institute, a former Raleigh Visiting Fellow. He's the author of Civil Wrongs, What Went Wrong with Affirmative Action, the new work almost completed In Defense of Logic, and a ton of insightful articles on LouRockwell.com. Mr. Yates also teaches philosophy classes at local business and technical colleges. Welcome to the show, Mr. Yates.
Thank you.
I wanted to get that clip of Bill Clinton praising Carol Quigley out of the way there, right at first, as way of introducing the topic that I brought you on to discuss, the book Tragedy and Hope by Carol Quigley. This book was published the year that Bill Clinton took Carol Quigley's Foreign Policy Studies class, 1966. And where the book really outlines the inner workings of the English and American establishments, Bill Clinton read his professor's book and said, "How do I join?" And his professor, Carol Quigley, apparently sent him off to Oxford to be a Rhodes Scholar and to join what Quigley calls the Anglo-American establishment. And really, the Bill Clinton thing is sort of just kind of an extra aside in this story, because Tragedy and Hope was big news in this country for a long time before anybody had ever even heard of Bill Clinton. Isn't that right?
That's true. You're talking about something that goes way, way back.
Well, maybe, first of all, we can talk a little bit about Carol Quigley, who he was, and why we ought to listen to anything he says, and then we can get to what he talks about.
Well, it's interesting that we begin with Carol Quigley, because encountering Carol Quigley's work, which was right around 1995, was kind of what dragged me kicking and screaming into this whole, I hate to use the word, but everybody knows what it means, conspiracy type notion. Because before that, I had been one of those people who basically poo-pooed the whole notion that there could be some interlocking group of organizations operating behind the scenes that were working little by little to bring about a world government, which seems to be the goal of the whole New World Order thing. I kind of dismissed that out of hand, and then one of my associates here in Columbia, South Carolina, told me, "You need to have a look at this." And he had a copy of the original Macmillan edition of Tragedy and Hope by Carol Quigley. Now, Carol Quigley was not somebody we could just dismiss out of hand. Carol Quigley was right there at the center of things. He was a professor of, I believe, political history at Georgetown University, and was intimately familiar with the groups about which he was writing. And as an established scholar, he'd already written a very well-received work called The Evolution of Civilizations. I believe that was before Tragedy and Hope.
Yeah, it was, and actually that was the textbook for History of Western Civilization 101 in the majority of universities all across the United States for, I think, 15 or 20 years.
And so we have to ask, this whole notion of conspiracy theory, and I keep calling it that because I'm really not working my way up to a better term, at least just yet. I prefer calling it a movement, but We'll get there. I dug out this quote that I thought I would read. It appeared in the Christian Science Monitor on May 13th, 1996. And the quote goes as follows. Conspiracy theory is doing America real harm. Long incubating underground, it has grown into the greatest enslaver of human minds since communism. It irrationalizes thinking on every issue. It kills. It turns millions of Americans against their own country. It undermines foreign policy by vilifying our government's every effort. Now, that's one point of view that's been out there. I would describe that as essentially the establishment point of view, and you get the same thing in works like Richard Hofstadter. What was the name of his essay? The Paranoid Theory in American Politics. But then you have people like Carol Quigley, on the other hand, who we have every reason to believe was one of the insiders himself and knew what he was talking about. Now, here's a quote that contrasts with the one that I just read a minute ago. This is from page 950 of his 1,300-odd-page book. There does exist and has existed for a generation an international Anglophile network which operates to some extent in the way the radical right believes the communists act. In fact, this network, which we may identify as the Roundtable Groups, has no aversion to cooperating with the communists or any other groups, and frequently does so. I know of the operations of this network because I have studied it for 20 years and was permitted for 2 years in the early 1960s to examine its papers and secret records. I have no aversion to it or to most of its aims, and have, for much of my life, been close to it and to many of its instruments. I have objected both in the past and recently to a few of its policies. But in general, my chief difference of opinion is that it wishes to remain unknown, and I believe its role in history is significant enough to be known. And that, end of quote. Now, that quote was one of the things that my associate drew to my attention, and it forced me to rethink my whole world view on the nature of modern history.
So what is this set of roundtable groups that Quigley describes then?
Well, Quigley actually takes us all the way back to at least as far back as Cecil Rhodes and folks who were operating right around the turn of the century. Now, Cecil Rhodes had studied at Oxford University under a professor by the name of John Ruskin, and John Ruskin had this idea that it was necessary to create a kind of secret society that whose purpose was to elevate the British working classes. And his student, Cecil Rhodes, of course, made a fortune in diamonds in South Africa, and there were several different wills, and I don't have all of the details sorted out here myself. This is very complex material. But essentially, Cecil Rhodes willed his fortune to the creation of such a society. And one of the things that came out of this was the Rhodes Scholarships. And also coming out of this was the formation of to use Quigley's term, the Roundtable Groups. And he describes these groups in great detail in a shorter and somewhat more accessible treatment called the Anglo-American Establishment.
Which wasn't, by the way, published until after his death.
Yes, that's true.
Okay.
This is the Anglo-American Establishment. I don't know when it was written, but it was published more recently, much more recently than Tragedy and Hope.
Pardon me, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Let me see, where should we go from there? Carol Quigley has a... There's a gold mine of quotations here for helping to understand kind of where we've been and where we might be going. Because he outlines in great detail the development of a number of different groups. I think chief among them is as one will want to talk about, the Council on Foreign Relations, the financial mechanisms that such groups would use to accomplish a global system of control. Now, I'll quote Tragedy and Hope again. I don't have a page number here, unfortunately. The powers of financial capitalism, I'm quoting Quigley now, had another far-reaching aim, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This system was to be controlled in a feudalist fashion by the central banks of the world acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at in frequent private meetings and conferences. The apex of the system was the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations. The growth of financial capitalism made possible a centralization of world economic control and use of this power for the direct benefit of financiers and the indirect injury of all other economic groups.
That's from page 324.
That's the 324? Okay, thank you.
Sure. So, in what era are we talking about here where these interests in financial capitalism had this aim to create this? To me, this is truthfully what got me interested in this many years ago myself, is the idea that the central banks are privately owned. They all meet together in their secret meetings and conferences and make their decisions, and then they come back and tell their political governments what to do instead of the other way around.
Well, we have the Federal Reserve System here. The Federal Reserve System was created in the United States in 1913. Yeah. Now, there had been attempts to create a central bank before. Like, I believe Abraham Lincoln gave it a shot. But they'd always been shot down. But in 1913, you had this secret Jekyll Island meeting, and they rushed through the Federal Reserve Act. I believe it was right around the time of Christmas. Most of Congress was gone, but the Federal Reserve Act became law, and all of a sudden, we had a central bank. And you had the usual suspects there. You had the Rockefellers, you had the Aldriches, and some other, the Carnegies, other names just associated with the elite groups of the time. So, in that way, these elite groups basically seized control of the finances of the country. And eventually, they would take us off the gold standard completely, although that would take several decades. And by the way, we're talking about a process here that is intergenerational. The people who started it back in the days of Rhodes and the early round table groups realized that they would not live to see the outcome of what they were doing. But they believed in this so strongly, and many of them almost certainly believed that what they were doing was the right thing.
And I think that's something probably that's lacking among people who talk about conspiracy behind global affairs, the idea that these are good men who just have been, someone got them to accept the idea that it's okay to force everyone to go along your way as long as it's for the greater good and the final outcome of peace on earth and a brotherhood of mankind and whatever. As long as that's the goal, then it's okay to do small bad things in order to make the one big good thing happen at the end, right?
Correct. As a philosopher, I can speak to that, because that's an ethical theory known as utilitarianism, that what we ought to do is pursue the greatest amount of good for the greatest number, which, you know, if you listen to that carefully, it does not say everybody. It basically opens the door to sacrificing some, like the popular phrase, you can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs. So it becomes okay to use force, to sacrifice some in the name of this utopia that's down the road. Now, having studied folks like Ludwig von Mises, the economist of the Austrian school, Friedrich A. Hayek, and a number of others, basically these folks argue in great detail that this sort of centralization just plain won't work.
Why not?
Why won't it work? Because human beings just fundamentally are individuals, just by their very nature. All of us have slightly different values, have slightly different goals, and interact with others in slightly different ways. And moreover, these goals are constantly shifting. Our values are constantly changing as we acquire new information. So what are our needs? It's going to change over time. It's going to be different for every person. And now you take this and take it way up the scale to where you're talking about an economy that involves millions of people buying, selling, transacting in other ways, seeking employment, starting businesses, so on and so forth. There is absolutely no way that you can have one person or one committee of persons or even one organization located at the center of power somewhere that can orchestrate every bit of this and create a planned global economy. We can't do it on a national level. It doesn't work on a national scale. You can't really have a planned economy in this sense. And some of the destabilizations and malinvestments that we've seen just in the past few years, Enron comes to mind. It was a malinvestment. But it's a product of this notion that you can have power centers, Federal Reserve, federal government, that can micromanage the economy. It doesn't work. We see the results. So if it can't work at a national level, it certainly won't work on a global scale, but have some kind of a global economy that is effectively planned in some sense. So where everybody is somehow lifted out of poverty or whatever is the aim.
Well, wouldn't the average roundtabler probably argue that they agree with you that, no, they're not trying to be, you know, the Soviet Union and centrally plan everything. They want to have a quasi-private economy where they just regulate it to make sure that it's in the interest of the common good and that kind of thing.
No, I'm not altogether sure who the average roundtabler is, but I see the point of your question. And I think what would go wrong is that the person who does not tighten down the screws that way, who kind of wants to straddle the fence, is going to find that that people are, when they're allowed to do so, they're going to make their own choices. And some of those choices are inevitably going to be different from what the central planners think that they should be doing. So the central planners start to interfere more and more, and you end up with a system that leans more and more towards some kind of an authoritarian society, increasingly so, and further towards dictatorship, because they cannot allow people to make their own choices, because that would defeat the whole purpose of the global planning. It contradicts it.
Well, the central planners have to adjust their central plans too, right? I mean, this conspiracy, for lack of a better word, beginning with Rhodes and Milner in the 1880s and 90s, they can't possibly be putting into effect the very same plan from back then today.
Oh, no. They've had to make some adjustments. There have been allegations, and I'm still working on this, that at least some of these groups bankrolled the rise of Hitler and the rise of the Nazis. Certainly, they didn't anticipate the depth of the evil that they were actually dealing with in this case, and they would have had to adjust accordingly. And Stalin got away from them too, because they were dealing with people who had their own agendas.
Yeah, I remember reading something about how right after the close of World War II, apparently there was a big movement of people calling themselves citizens of the world, and that they really wanted to go ahead and try to go for full-fledged world government with the very inception of the United Nations, but that they had to, because of probably mostly domestic opposition here at home among conservatives and anti-communists, that they decided to go ahead and have a Cold War instead and put it off another 50 years, split the world in half, and play the two halves off against each other for a while.
Right. That's the divide and conquer principle. Create two opponents, fund both of them lavishly, and set them against one another. The net result is a lot of confusion and chaos, and those who want power then come in and restore order. It's happened several times throughout our history. But the UN, of course, was really the second attempt, the first one being the League of Nations, which started to get off the ground during the Wilson administration. Wilsonianism being really the first full-fledged interventionist administration. And of course, that's the era that also gave rise to Edward Mandel House and his book, Philip True Administrator.
Mm-hmm. Which was published anonymously, and it didn't come out for 25 years that it was House who had written it. And which, by the way, Mussolini praised as his inspiration for the plan of fascist Italy.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, in Norman Gregg's foreword to the new edition of Philip True Administrator, he quotes the New York Times as quoting Mussolini, talking about, wow, I read this Philip True, and it gave me a great idea as to how to set up my dictatorship down in Italy. Thanks a lot, whoever wrote this anonymous book.
I do recall allegations, reading about them, that during the period of the Wilson administration, that Edward Mandel House was the real president, quote-unquote. There's several photographs in various places. Wilson is at the center, of course, because he's president, but House is right there at his side in all of those photos.
And of course,
so
Wilson,
who's really running the show is the question.
And Wilson called House my alter ego. If I wasn't there and he makes the decision in my place, I surely would have done the same thing.
Endorses it, yes.
Yes. G.O. Griffin actually has written quite a bit about Colonel House's role in the Wilson administration. Really, I don't know if I could just sum it up fast, my understanding of Colonel House's history. He arranged the election in 1912 where they brought in Theodore Roosevelt as the bull moose to split the Republican vote and secure the election of Woodrow Wilson, the Democrat. He was, according to his biographer at Yale, the unseen guardian angel of the Federal Reserve Act. He pretended that the 16th Amendment, the income tax, was passed when it wasn't, and led that drive to fool people into accepting that. He was, really, him and his study group came up with the 14 points and the League of Nations. He is the guy who was in Europe negotiating our entry into World War I while Wilson was campaigning on the slogan, "He kept us out of war." And he is the guy who, when the League of Nations was rejected by the United States Senate, he's the guy who reorganized the American Roundtable Group into what it is now known in New York as the Council on Foreign Relations. And this is the guy that Wilson called my alter ego in the era where government stopped being limited and started being good and democratic.
And started expanding. And, of course, you mentioned the income tax amendment, the founding of the Internal Revenue Service, or as some people like to call it, the Infernal Revenue Service. All of a sudden, expansionist government had a perfect source of revenue, just tax people's personal incomes. Well, the Constitution does talk about a tax, but it doesn't talk about taxing personal incomes. Important difference.
Well, actually, it sure does talk about it. It forbids it explicitly.
Well, yes, that's true.
And, of course, you know, they got the income tax passed in, I forget if it was 1913 or 1914, and they had us in a war in Europe within 3 years.
1913, that year was a disaster. That was the year of both the income tax, I mean, the Federal Reserve and the Internal Revenue Service created the same year. That year was a disaster for the country.
And there's no way that they could have paid for American involvement in World War I if they didn't have that Federal Reserve mechanism for creating new money, isn't that right?
That's true. The Federal Reserve System, Gary North could explain this better than I could, operates essentially under the assumption that you can create wealth out of thin air, fiat money, fiat paper currency. It puts us on away from a gold-based system, which is objective, to a paper-based system, which is entirely subjective. And so, one of
what exactly do you mean by that, objective and subjective, in terms of the money supply?
Well, objective meaning backed by something definite, physical, like gold. That means that you have a fixed amount of currency, and that currency has a definite backing in gold, something where there is a fixed amount of it. Now, the traditional economists, at least as I understood them, and even Karl Marx, I think, would have accepted this point, that wealth must be produced. It can't be pulled out of thin air. Well, once you instituted this paper money system, it became, or at least took on the appearance that you could create wealth out of thin air. They were really borrowing against the future, of course, because you're talking about a system that ultimately isn't sustainable. The fact that we went completely off the gold standard under Nixon took us off the gold standard. I forget whether it was 71 or 72. At that time, the federal debt was what? Do you have a figure? I forgot to look this up.
I don't know exactly, but I think it was under $100 billion. Or I think
it was small compared to today. And since that day, our national debt has skyrocketed. Now it's upward of $6.7 trillion. It's zeroing in on $7 trillion just a little at a time. I imagine we'll hit $7 trillion sometime before the next election day.
Just the budget deficit for this year alone is over $500 billion, if you count all the war money.
Yeah, this is what surprises so many of us. George W. Bush, a Republican, has turned out to be a much bigger spender than Bill Clinton was, a Democrat. You know, normally we associate Democrats with big government, big spending, and Republicans with some kind of financial sanity, smaller government. But it turns out that no matter which of the two dominant parties sits in the White House or controls Congress, the country keeps moving in essentially the same direction. And Carol Quigley discussed this as well. Let me read something there where he addressed this point directly, if I can find it. Oh, here it is. Control and manipulation of political parties and the political process generally. And this is Quigley speaking again. I quote, "The chief problem of American political life for a long time has been how to make the two congressional parties more national and international. The argument that the two parties should represent opposed ideals and policies, one perhaps of the right and the other of the left, is a foolish idea, acceptable only to doctrinaire and academic thinkers. Instead, the two parties should be almost identical, so that the American people can, to quote, throw the rascals out at any election without leading to any profound or extensive shift in policy. So, given when Quigley was writing, and that certainly explains why the country keeps moving towards more and more globalism, at the very least. Why, for example, take education policy, for example. I've been challenging anybody who would do it to tell me how Bush's education policy differs from Clinton's.
I can't see any difference. More expensive.
Well, aside from that, of course. Aside from those things, they're going in the same direction. They have basically the same philosophy of control. Under Clinton, it was called the School to Work Opportunities Act. George W. Bush, it's No Child Left Behind.
Also, I noticed that conservatives made a big stink about Clinton's Freedom Corps, and they love Bush's Clinton's AmeriCorps and Bush's Freedom Corps.
Hmm.
They just love the Freedom Corps. Now that service, I can appreciate that as long as it's in the service of a Republican state.
Well, how true. But I hate to say it, but Republicans, the card-carrying kind, tend to be naive about these sorts of things. For some reason, they don't see the big picture. I'm at a loss to explain this as much as anyone.
My best guess is it's a matter of just television and personalities. And people don't talk about the Bush administration. They talk about President Bush. And people didn't talk about the Clinton administration. They talked about President Clinton. And if they can replace one personality that they don't like so much with another personality that they trust a little more, then the details can be damned. TV said that things are better now than they were, so...
There's definitely something to that. You notice the shift of language there, and people will hop on board anything that has the word freedom in it. Operation Iraqi Freedom, to take an example that just springs to mind. But the control over language and is certainly part of this.
Maybe we could take some time, I think. I don't want to get too far ahead before we really, if I can ask you, show me how the, well, let's see, I guess we got from John Ruskin and Cecil Rhodes, at least through the Wilson administration, but let's see if we can explain a continuity of power arising from the Council on Foreign Relations in New York City and maybe show people, prove to them that it actually really has been, just like Carol Quigley said, the two parties being almost identical and just trading off just to fool us, and that it really has been one single line of power from, I mean, because that's quite an assertion if we're talking about from World War I days up until right now, almost to the end of 2003. How can it be shown that this same group of roundtablers and Rockefeller and Morgan partners are still the people in charge in the United States and England today?
How can we show it? Well, there's really, do we have 4 or 5 hours? No.
No, actually, though, I do not have a second guest for the second hour, so if I can get you to stay on, we still have another half an hour left to go already, but if I can get you to stay over, that you're perfectly welcome to.
Well, unfortunately, I do have a commitment, so I won't be able to do that, and I'm very sorry.
Oh, that's okay. I think we should be able to sketch pretty easy from World War One until now, from the point of view of what the Council on Foreign Relations' role in this has been, don't you think?
Sure. Just one point of clarification first, and G. Edward Griffin discusses this in some of his more recent work. Now, we're talking about the Council on Foreign Relations. Now, there's something like 3,600 members of the Council on Foreign Relations, and they aren't all equally involved at the same level, but... Griffin introduces the idea of inner circles and control, where you have different groups doing different things, and they don't all know, they aren't all aware of one another. So there, unquestionably, there's a lot of people that are members of the CFR for whom it's really just a glorified job finding service, and membership in the CFR is considered pretty prestigious. So you can't just apply to join. You have to be nominated by someone who's already on the inside. But that said, the CFR goes back to 1922 and began, that was the year it also began publishing its own journal, Foreign Affairs. And it's interesting to go through some of the issues of foreign affairs and find occasionally explicit calls for world government that would be developed at the expense of America's independence. Now, the most, I'm getting ahead of things here a little bit because you wanted to say something about World War I and World War II, but in 1974, there was this article by Richard N. Gardner entitled The Hard Road to World Order, and this article just explicitly stated, let me read the quote, "The house of world order will have to be built from the bottom up rather from the top down. An end run around national sovereignty, eroding it piece by piece, will accomplish much more than the old-fashioned frontal assault." Now, well, we've seen that from groups of individuals on the inside, and the Council on Foreign Relations does seem to be one of the leading groups here. And if you look at the members of, or the people on both Clinton's administration and also on Bush's among his foreign policy people, the Brain Trust, it's practically a who's who of people who are members. They're all members of the CFR, with very few exceptions. There's one or two exceptions in there, but Condoleezza Rice, George Shultz, Richard Armitage, Dick Cheney, Richard Pearl, Paul Wolfowitz, Colin Powell, they're all in the CFR. And if you look at Clinton's administration, you get you can make a similar list. And all the presidents, I believe George W. Bush is a member, but I could be wrong. I haven't been able to verify that one way or another.
I don't believe that George W. Bush is. His father was the president of the Council on Foreign Relations for a while in the 70s. In fact,
there's no doubt.
Since Franklin Roosevelt, the only three presidents who have not been Council on Foreign Relations members, I believe, are Reagan, Johnson, and Bush Jr. And all three of those presidents still were completely surrounded by them. So.
They were completely surrounded by them, and I think there's a question mark by John F. Kennedy, who, if I'm remembering this correctly, he said he was a member, but his name didn't turn up on the membership lists for those respective years. So we just have to put a question mark by that one.
Well, and we also know that Nixon denied he was a member, but then it was proved that his name was on the list.
Oh, yeah, no doubt there. He was a member. Another area where we can look, if we're looking for details on how this intergenerational process developed throughout the 20th century, is to look at these huge tax-exempt foundations. I thought the most famous of which, I think, is the Rockefeller Foundation. I don't know if anybody knows for sure how much money has been put into the Rockefeller Foundation, but and it's bankrolled everything from progressive education back in the early decades of this century up through the sex education movement as it was getting off the ground in the 50s and especially in the 1960s. And you can look at the Ford Foundation, and the Ford Foundation was directly involved in reworking the entire teaching of history, particularly at the university level. The American Historical Association, which is the largest organization of academic historians in the country, is essentially a product of Ford Foundation money. And then there's the Carnegie Financial Empire, which has several subsidiary organizations, like the Carnegie Endowment for Peace is one of them, Carnegie Corporation is another, and there's several more, have really had a heavy hand in public education throughout the very and we're talking about a state of affairs here that's been going on for decades,
and not just in education but in the leadership of the political administrations too. I mean, my understanding is that really, I guess, the Coolidge and Harding administrations were pretty much free of these guys. But then, starting with Hoover and FDR and all the way through up until now, that every Speaker of the House of Representatives has been a Council on Foreign Relations member, except, I believe, one for about a year in the 50s. Every Secretary of State, every member of the Federal Reserve Board, the leadership, not just in big government, but also of big business, all the biggest banks and the biggest multinational corporations, like you mentioned, academia, and in mass media, too, the editors of the major papers and the guys who run the biggest TV news networks are all members of the Council on Foreign Relations as well, and have been.
Oh, sure, that's definitely true, and I can give you a list here of publications and people who've had people in top management that were CFR, American Spectator, the Atlanta Journal Constitution, Associated Press, the Christian Science Monitor, which I quoted earlier, Foreign Affairs, obviously, the Dow Jones News Service, USA Today, Wall Street Journal, Los Angeles Times, New York Times, obviously, Random House, the publisher, W.W. Norton, the publisher, Warner Books, Harper's, Washington Times, believe that or not, National Review, New Republic, The New Yorker, The Progressive, Reader's Digest, Rolling Stone, Scientific American, Time, obviously, U.S. News and World Report, Washington Post. The list just goes on. It's largely alphabetical. But ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox News, CNN, PBS, Walt Disney, all of them are heavily involved, have people in top management, I should say, that are heavily involved with the CFR. And media personalities, and these are people that John Q. Public tends to trust that are CFR members. David Brinkley, Tom Brokaw, William Buckley, Dan Rather, Diane Sawyer, Barbara Walters. And the number of university presidents, professors, department chairs, and members of boards of directors and boards of trustees and that are CFR members, the number I have is 563. And by the way, the source of these names and figures is G. Edward Griffin again.
Who's always an excellent source for this sort of information.
Corporations that are where the CEO or members of the board of members of their boards have been CFR members. Atlantic Richfield, AT&T, Avon, Bechtel, Boeing, Chevron, Coca-Cola, Exxon, Dow Chemical, DuPont, Eastman Kodak, Enron, that's interesting, Estee Lauder, Ford Motor, General Electric, Hewlett-Packard, IBM, International Paper, Johnson & Johnson, Lucent Technologies, Pacific Gas and Electric, Phillips Petroleum, Procter & Gamble, Shell Oil, Sprint, Texaco. The list just goes on and on.
And I'd like to mention here, if I can, there's an excellent book from, I believe, the late 70s called Trilateralism. It's edited by an academic by the name of Holly Sklar. And I believe it's about 10 or 15 different, very academic essays about the Council on Foreign Relations and its subsidiary organizations like the Trilateral Commission and others. And the book is actually kind of quite outdated, being published in the late 70s, but since we're talking about the history of almost the whole 20th century here, they actually do an excellent job, and I don't think they're really trying to make this point the way I'm making it, but they really show how all of the international organizations going back, like we were talking about before, from the League of Nations and the Bank for International Settlements, all the way through the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the United Nations, all the different import-export banks and who knows what, the World Trade Organization, the biggest disarmament treaties and programs like that have all come from study groups at the Council on Foreign Relations. The UN Charter was literally written up by Nelson Rockefeller and his group at the Council on Foreign Relations, who turned around and handed it to FDR, who went on TV or the radio or whatever as soon as he could and said, here we go, here's my plan for the United Nations. And so that, I guess really what I'm trying to get to is the hard part here, Mr. Yates, or I should say Dr. Yates, and that is that we're the ones who created this world government. We, in the collective sense of the United States of America, we're the ones responsible for this world order. We're forcing every nation on earth into it, whether they want to be part of it or not. And at the same time, we insist on absolute immunity for ourselves. This and that treaty don't apply to us. The International Criminal Court doesn't apply to us. The different laws of war, Iraq and no one else is allowed. Iraq is not allowed to violate UN Security Council resolutions. Only Israel and Great Britain and the United States are allowed to do that. And it just seems to me like there's a really big backlash coming because we cannot be the enforcers of world order and then insist to the whole world that we are immune from it. It's one of those things where you can't have it both ways. Either we've got to renounce this ourselves and pull back immediately, or there's going to be a big backlash coming where we don't have a choice but to accept world order. The American people, we won't have a choice anymore.
Well, some would say that that backlash started with 9/11. Now, I don't know if it's we can rest content with that or not, because we're still so close to it, historically speaking. It's only been 2 years, but it raises a question: is this fundamentally the U.S.? Well, the main players, of course, do seem. Are all from the English-speaking world, either America or Great Britain. And by the way, meant to say it earlier before the point gets away from me, there is a British equivalent of the Council on Foreign Relations. I believe it's called the Royal Institute for International Affairs. It was founded right around the same time and had the same source of money from the Rhodes fortune. But actually, this isn't an intrinsically American U.S. movement, if by that we mean, if we can define America, if we can define the U.S. in terms of a constitutional republic, which simply does not try to, by its very nature, does not try to impose its own way of doing things, economically, politically, or otherwise, all over the world. So, and naturally, that's what we've been doing for really in the Middle East for the past 50 years, ever since the CIA coup that threw out a popularly elected president in Iran and then instilled the Shah. The Shah of Iran went on to butcher his own people for the next 25 years, which, by the way, I have to chuckle at the people who say that the reason we had to get rid of Saddam Hussein was that he was an evil tyrant who butchered his own people, because the U.S. has a history of backing dictators who butchered their own people if they merely stated that they were anti-communist. Now, the Shah was certainly anti-communist, but he was also one of the most brutal dictators in that whole region for 25 years, and that was sort of one of the primary incubators of Islamic fundamentalism, which may be around, has become a major problem in its own right now, because they want nothing to do with our New World Order.
Well, and our fight against them is serving to speed along our convergence with the former Soviet Union, the former Warsaw Pact nations of Eastern Europe. I mean, NATO really goes from Alaska all the way around the Northern Hemisphere to Alaska again at this point. And it's all in the name of fighting the war on terrorism. So these terrorists who think they're fighting the New World Order are actually just kicking it in the ass and getting it going.
Well, unfortunately, that's probably true.
What can we do about this, Dr. Yates? How are the American people who, I don't believe, ever wanted empire, I believe we have to be fooled into accepting all these wars every time. Is there any sort of plan to take first and foremost our foreign policy away from these roundtabler types and renounce not just the neocon doctrine of unilateralist intervention, but just renounce all intervention and become a peace-loving republic before that backlash comes too big?
Well, it's going to be very, very difficult. The first thing is, from recognizing where we are now, my perception is that while the majority of the public is vaguely dissatisfied with the way things are going in the country, at the same time, very few people actually believe that something on the scale of a single international movement, or even a cluster of closely related international movements, I don't think most people really believe that this sort of thing is going on. And it's useful to point out that the control of the educational system by Carnegie Corporation types and internationalists and globalists has created a situation where public schools now turn out graduating seniors who can barely read, much less think deeply about issues like this. So educating the public is where I would like to begin, but that's a long road, and we might have to proceed in essentially the same way that the other side did, which was to infiltrate, as the Italian Marxist philosopher Antonio Gramsci coined that phrase, the long march through the institutions. Well, the John Birch Society, another one of those organizations that's routinely smeared in the media, probably because they, there's any organization that over the years has done more to try to expose this whole thing, I can't imagine who it would be. But they've organized cells and chapters, study groups, and that have, I don't want to say infiltrated areas of government, but the people will go in and talk to senators and House members and others to try to influence their votes on certain pieces of legislation. So that's the sort of thing we have to do, only on a much larger scale than we're doing it now.
Yeah, well, we're giving it a shot on what scale we can. And in terms of education and that kind of thing and getting the public from the bottom up knowledgeable about such things, I thought maybe we'd spend a few minutes here at the end recommending some books to people who want to understand maybe the way things really work in the, to use Quigley's phrase, Anglo-American establishment.
Sure. I have a number of things sitting here, which, let's see, I mentioned Carol Quigley's own thing. I would recommend that people wanting to know about the Federal Reserve and its shady origins should certainly read G. Edward Griffin's The Creature from Jekyll Island. That's really the only book you need to read about the Federal Reserve. And there is a book, what's good about this book is that it's a nice, slim little volume which you can read in a couple of sittings and really absorb a lot of information in a hurry. It's called Reinventing Government, Fast Bullets and Culture Changes, a special report from the Murchison Chair of Free Enterprise, which is based in Austin, Texas. The author is a historian, Robert T. Hillman, and so far as I know, the book is only available on one website, unfortunately, which is Sovereignty International's website, www.sovereignty.net. And that's the only place I've ever seen it, and I certainly encourage people to take a look at that book. On the education front, I would recommend, it's expensive but it's worth it, $40, The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America by Charlotte Thompson Iserbeit. And what's interesting about her is that she's not concentrating on the conspiracy movement aspect of things. She is merely going decade by decade by decade and showing what's been done to public education over the years. But she singles out the usual suspects. You will find references to the Council on Foreign Relations. You'll learn about the involvement of the Rockefeller Foundation and the Carnegie Corporation in education. And John Taylor Gatto's book kind of complements Iserbeit's. His also enormous and worth reading, The Underground History of American Education, A School Teacher's Intimate Investigation into the Problem of Modern Schooling. Now, from him, you will also find out more than a lot of people focus on progressive education and John Dewey and things like that without recognizing that it was the Rockefellers that bankrolled John Dewey's progressive education. John Dewey had tried some experiments that were total failures. The kids didn't learn anything. But essentially, that's what the elites want, is people who can't really learn, because they basically want to be able to rule over a population of sheep. That's, hate to say it, but that's basically the case. And now we've reached that point where we have Supreme Court justices asking whether or not the Constitution will survive in a global age.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. They're the lifelong appointed guardians of the Constitution.
Now, one other thing I would like to say, and I suppose we're running out of time coming up on the end of the hour here.
Well, we've still got about 3 minutes.
Okay. Well, Let me just talk then about the internet for a minute, because just over the past few years we've had this wonderful new tool of it all of a sudden surrounds us completely, and I mean I'm totally dependent on it for sources of information. It's useful to note that a lot of information about this new world order is right there on the internet, and it's not on Joe Blow's conspiracy site, which some fellow who lives in the backwoods of South Carolina put up. These things are on, for example, the UN's own website. For example, there's a document there called Agenda 21, and it can be had just on the UN's own website. Division of Sustainable Development, which that's a conversation in itself. But what Agenda 21 is, just packed into one or two sentences here, it's essentially a plan to control the resources of the entire world, to control the global economy by controlling controlling the flow of resources. What it says on the website itself. Agenda 21 is a comprehensive plan of action to be taken globally, nationally, and locally by organizations of the United Nations systems, governments, and major groups in every area in which human impacts on the environment. So we're talking about a movement here that basically has, has tentacles everywhere. It's involved in the environmentalist movement. It's involved in education. It's involved in efforts to keep the races divided from one another. I'm sure they've... I don't have immediate data on this, but it wouldn't surprise me any that they've been involved in bankrolling the feminist movement, and so on and so forth.
Do you ever talk to any of the other guys at LouRockwell.com or the Mises Institute about Carol Quigley and about the Council on Foreign Relations and this kind of history?
Oh, sure. The books are there in the Mises Institute's library, and we've had a couple of detailed presentations on it, one by one other scholar who says that he was inspired by one of my early articles, the one on Carol Quigley and the UN Millennium Summit, which is in the LouRockwell.com archive. He began investigating this and opened up a whole new world. I don't have all the answers. For example, I haven't said anything about the Skull and Bones, curious bunch that the Bushes are apparently involved in, having come from Yale. I don't know how they fit in for sure.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and recommend America's Secret Establishment, An Introduction to the Order of Skull and Bones by Dr. Anthony C. Sutton. And I think that'll begin to clear up a lot of things. And in fact, I think there's a new book coming out by a guy named Chris Milligan, who I interviewed, also called Fleshing Out Skull and Bones. It's supposed to be coming out this fall. That is a collection of quite a few different scholars' works on that. And really, I mean, truthfully, what you learn in Anthony Sutton's book is that they were founded in the 1830s on principles of statism and collectivism, and looking at the dialectic thesis, antithesis, synthesis model of history, not just as a way to look at history, but a way to create history as a plan. If you control this side and you control that side, then you control whatever the conflict resolution is in the end. And they were really founded on those principles back in the 1830s, and apparently have put them to quite good use ever since. In fact, I should also mention that at least one of the front runners for the Democratic nomination in 2004 is John Kerry, is also a member of the Order of Skull and Bones.
That's true. That's interesting. That had slipped my mind.
And do you have a couple more minutes, or should I just go ahead and let you go?
Well, I have a commitment at 6:30. I could stick around for a couple more minutes.
Okay, well, you let me know, and I'll let you go. Well, shit, I forgot what I was going to say now.
Well, 6:30 my time. I'm on the Eastern time zone over here.
Right. Okay, well, I just want to mention a couple of more authors and books on top of what you said about this kind of subject. Oh, now I remember what I was going to say again after that. Trilateralism, I mentioned by Holly Sklar, is a very scholarly work.
Interesting, if you don't mind me interrupting just a second to make a remark, Holly Sklar is often associated with the radical left rather than the radical right. And I find that interesting, that there are some people that I know of Chomsky, would also fall into this category, who have come to very similar conclusions on the whole New World Order. Chomsky has a book out called World Orders Old and New. Unfortunately, I haven't read it, but I have read about it, and he has some similar conclusions about this whole notion of American empire, which he rejects, obviously.
Right. Well, I don't want to characterize Chomsky too much without having him here, but he tends to always hold America to the UN Charter standard instead of our own Constitution standard. And he seems to me like the kind of guy who wouldn't mind a New World Order as long as it was a left-wing socialist New World Order, not a right-wing fascist capitalist global corporation style one.
I didn't mean to suggest that he is really our friend, so to speak, but I have found reading him useful from time to time.
Oh, absolutely, that's beyond dispute. And as far as just his bibliographies and his footnotes, I think are probably unmatched by anyone in American history. Truthfully.
His stuff is very well referenced. That's true, but. I think that where he goes wrong is that he really does hate this country, and this is why he blames the U.S. first for everything, and just goes overboard with it. And he's a much bigger fan of the U.N. than any of us.
Yeah, well.
And so he goes wrong on these specific points.
I tend to forgive him too, because I tend to think that he's fooled into believing it. I don't see him as a shill, but I know that. Well, for example, when they had the World Economic Forum in New York, and I think it was the early part of 2002,
yeah.
All the bankers came in, and I love this left-wing phrase, in solidarity with the Wall Street victims in New York, and so they had their World Economic Forum there, and Noam Chomsky was the featured speaker at the World Social Forum, in Rio de Janeiro at the exact same time, the exact same weekend, and the World Social Forum was promoting globalization for the people instead of for the corporations. And Chomsky gave the keynote speech, and, you know, the slightest bit of investigation leads to the obvious fact that both the World Economic Forum in New York and the World Social Forum in Rio de Janeiro on that same weekend were all being funded by, again, guess who? The Ford and the Rockefeller Foundations and the very same people. So you get you get to choose your hat. And I really believe that Chomsky, and I really need to have him on the show and argue this point with him myself, but I don't see him as a shill. I see that he really believes it and really thinks that a world socialist government would be so much better than the New World Order we're getting now.
Oh, I'm sure he does believe it. It just comes through in what I've read of his stuff. Yes, he believes it, I think.
And I remember now the question that I forgot that I was going to ask you, which was, really, I guess, is it even okay? Should we even have spent this hour talking about Quigley and even going so far as to mention the Order of Skull and Bones and this kind of thing, when really, truthfully, being a limited republic advocating free market capitalist type is hard enough? Without, you know, that's all ready to be sidelined to the margins without adding conspiracy theorists on top of that. Should we just put Quigley aside and just stick to what's going on today and what's wrong about it and not further marginalize ourselves by quoting this eminently quotable book?
Well, no, I think it's useful to bring Quigley into the picture and even keep him at the center of things, simply because this book is so important. And of course, if I can wax autobiographical here, this was the book that really persuaded me to take all of this seriously, to make me aware that something of this order was going on. And if it convinced me, and I'm as skeptical as they come, certainly it could be used to convince others, particularly in this internet age, which was just getting off the ground back in the old days when I first started learning about this.
And I have to say, I read a little book about maybe 100 pages thick published in 1971 called None Dare Call It Conspiracy when I was in high school. And in that book, Gary Allen quotes Carol Quigley at length. And I remember thinking, you know, I don't know about this author very much, but this professor he keeps quoting really seems to have it down.
I read that as an undergraduate. We laughed about those things in those days.
Well, and all the Quigley that you need, really, are the best quotes out of Quigley are in that book, and that's what did it for me. It wasn't Gary Allen. It was the quotes of Carol Quigley. And again, that book was published in 71, long before Bill Clinton or his connection to Quigley were of any importance to anyone. So, okay, I like that answer because it's basically the same one I came up with, which is, hey, okay, fine, call it conspiracy theory if you want, but this is the guy that sent Bill Clinton off to Oxford to be a Rhodes Scholar, so he must have had some idea what he was talking about. It seems to have worked out really well for Bill.
Sure. I would almost prefer calling it, like, just going ahead and calling it the New World Order movement or something of that order. Is it really a conspiracy when you can find this stuff on the organization's own websites? Like Agenda 21 on the UN's own website. Is it really a conspiracy? Of course, it's a scary thought. Maybe they have us where they want us or think they do.
Yeah, I wonder sometimes whether maybe we're just helping them by undermining... we're attempting to undermine their illegitimate authority in an attempt to save our Constitution, but in truth, I mean, in a land where most people don't differentiate between their country and their government, we might just be helping to overthrow the Constitution for them.
Well, I hope not.
An end run around national sovereignty, right? You got to have... it's got to look like a fumbling, buzzing confusion, but really it's not.
No, it isn't. And that's... If we can keep focused on notions like a constitutional republic and going back to the Bill of Rights and things like that, and recognizing that the notion of not just national sovereignty but state sovereignty, the notion of dual sovereignty, that these things were hammered out at the country's founding, and draw the contrast between those and what we see today, which is meddling everywhere in the world, and what kinds of troubles it's gotten us into, example in the Middle East over the past 50 years. If we can focus on the contrast between those two, maybe we can get somewhere, at least in the minds of some people in the public that are willing to be educated.
Well, and you know, I'm not sure if this was something that I read an article of yours on Lou Rockwell. I think it must have been, although, no, I don't know, it might have been something else. But I read something where, in the polls, I think it was almost a fifth of people identify their values as libertarian values, and they always end up voting for a Democrat or a Republican, I guess, just because they hate the other one more. But, you know, for fully a fifth of the American people to say, yeah, individual liberty, private property, no welfare for grandma or for a corporation, and that kind of thing... That's a pretty good start, you know. If it's already a fifth of us and a good 40% of us probably don't care at all, then we don't really have that many people left to convince, it seems like, maybe, hopefully.
Well, I don't know. It kind of depends on if people are just using those phrases or if they've really thought them through and understand the philosophy behind them. If they understand the philosophy behind them, then I think you're going to have to conclude that you can't really support a demo Republican.
Yeah, well, the last time I voted for a Democrat or a Republican in the actual election, I always vote against the guy I hate the most in the primaries. But in a general election, the last time I voted for a Democrat or a Republican was to vote for Ann Richards, who I despised at the time because she was running against George Bush Jr. back when I was still in high school. It was my first vote, and it was the only one I've ever cast for a Democrat or a Republican.
That's interesting.
Well, hey, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Yates, for coming on the show today. Everybody,
sure, it's been very enjoyable.
Well, good. I'm glad you had a good time. Everyone, Stephen Yates has a PhD in philosophy. He's an adjunct scholar at the Ludwig von Mises Institute for Austrian Economics. He's a former rally-visiting fellow. He's the author of Civil Wrongs, What Went Wrong with Affirmative Action, and he's almost finished with a new book, In Defense of Logic. If you go to lourockwell.com, you can find his archives under the name Stephen Yates. There's a ton of really good articles there. Thank you a lot for coming on the show, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you wonder why I always dress in black, why you never see bright colors on my back, and why does my appearance seem to have a somber tone? Well, there's a reason for the things that I have on. I wear the black for the poor and the beaten down, living in the hopeless, hungry side of town. I wear it for the prisoner who has long paid for his crime, but is there because he's a victim of the time. I wear the black for those who've never read